taking their place in a long, true line of everyday Americans.
Helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and we study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. We teach ourselves to be free. We try to teach everybody to be free. Glad you could join me today. You know, there's been a lot of talk lately about the recent arguments, oral arguments in the Supreme Court about the Mississippi abortion law. Now, there's a lot more to come because, you know, the court still has to come up with their opinion and publish it. There's a lot that goes in there. But I want to take an initial look at the case based only on the oral arguments. The Supreme Court opinions in Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey have been political footballs since the day they were decided. A recent Mississippi law placed restrictions on abortions within that state that contradict the standards set by Roe and Casey. Not surprisingly, a lawsuit was filed challenging the Mississippi law. Recently, oral arguments in this case were heard at the Supreme Court. I found a number of arguments that I believe anyone interested in what the Constitution actually says would find worth their time. The plaintiff, Thomas E. Dobbs, is the state health officer for the Mississippi Department of Health. In 2018, Mississippi enacted the Gestational Age Act, which prohibited abortions after 15 weeks gestation, except in medical emergencies or where severe fetal abnormalities were found. Jackson's Women's Health sued in federal district court and won. The case was appealed to the Fifth Court, which agreed with the district court. Mr. Dobbs then petitioned the Supreme Court for review of the case. Scott Stewart, the Solicitor General of Mississippi, argued first, and he started out with a bang. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey haunt our country. They have no basis in the Constitution. They have no home in our history or traditions. They've damaged the democratic process. They've poisoned the law. They've choked off compromise. For 50 years, they've kept this court at the center of a political battle that it can never resolve. And 50 years on, they stand alone. Nowhere else does this court recognize a right to end a human life. I've talked before about the Roe opinion, but I believe Mr. Stewart is just as correct about Casey. Both claim that a woman's right to liberty supersedes the right to life of the child in the womb, at least until the point of viability. Now, as I understand it, the main difference between Roe and Casey is Roe used an arbitrary trimester approach, while Casey used an arbitrary undue burden one. See, Roe divided a woman's pregnancy into three trimesters and set conditions and exceptions on that schedule, while Casey looked to see if the state law imposed an undue burden on the exercise of a woman's liberty to terminate her pregnancy. Now, both found this right to abortion in the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, specifically the right to not be deprived of liberty without due process of law. For 50 years, Roe and Casey have been at the center of a political battle, and the court has been a willing participant. When was the last time the confirmation of a federal judge did not include the question of whether or not they support Roe? How long has the Senate used the stare decisis as a sword of Damocles above the heads of nominated judges, requiring a demonstration of fealty to the right of abortion? Mr. Stewart pointed out, consider this case. The Mississippi law here prohibits abortion after 15 weeks. The law includes robust exceptions for a woman's life and health. It leaves months to obtain an abortion, yet the courts below struck the law down. It didn't matter that the law apply, that the law applies when an unborn child is undeniably human, when risk to women surge, and when the common abortion procedure is brutal. The lower courts held that because the law prohibits abortions before viability, it is unconstitutional no matter what. To me, the law in question seems more than reasonable, even if 15 weeks is just another arbitrary time frame. However, Justice Breyer points out the crux of the question. What stare decisis principles should be used to overrule a case like Roe? And they say Roe is special. What's special about it? They say it's rare. They call it a watershed. Why? Because the country is divided, because feelings run high. And yet, the country, for better or worse, decided to resolve their differences by this court, laying down a constitutional principle, in this case, woman's choice. All right, that's what makes it rare. While oral arguments discuss many questions about the Mississippi law, the big question revolves around stare decisis, Latin for let the decision stand. Justice Breyer says they claim Roe is special because it is rare, but how rare is it? Sure, there aren't many cases about abortion that get to the Supreme Court, but there are plenty of cases where the court has found a right that isn't in the language of the Constitution. Breyer says people claim Roe is special because the country is divided, but the country is divided over many things, not just abortion. Then Justice Breyer claims the country decided to resolve these differences by having the court lay down a constitutional principle. However, the country did not ask the court to decide this issue. A small group of activists did. The country did not consent to the court's laying down constitutional principles, but the court did. Now, Justice Breyer went on, "That's not what I'm asking about. I want your reaction to what they said follows from that. What the court said follows from that is that it should be more unwilling to overrule a prior case. Far more unwilling we should be, whether that case is right or wrong, than the ordinary case. That, to me, is the crux of the matter. Because that is what really makes Roe and Casey rare and dangerous. The court's unwillingness to change its mind, even when it's wrong." Of course, according to Justice Breyer, it's not the court's fault. And why? Well, they have a lot of words there, but I'll give you about 10 or 20. There will be inevitable efforts to overturn it. Of course there will. Feelings run high. And it is particularly important to show what we do in overruling a case is grounded in principle and not social pressure, not political pressure. Only the most convincing justification can show that a latter decision overruling, if that's what we do, was anything but a surrender to political pressures or new members. And that is an unjustified repudiation of principles on which the court stakes its authority. The reason the Roe and Casey decisions are wrong is not because feelings run high. And the reason to overturn it has nothing to do with political pressure. In fact, I would say it is political pressure that has kept these bad opinions around for so long. So why does Justice Breyer believe the court should be so reluctant to overturn precedent? Overruling unnecessarily and under pressure would lead to condemnation, the court's loss of confidence in the judiciary, the ability of the court to exercise the judicial power and to function as a Supreme Court of a nation dedicated to the rule of law. Isn't it the fact that courts are so reticent to change their minds on a wrong opinion that truly causes a lack of confidence in the judiciary? How can a member of the court claim it is the court of a nation dedicated to the rule of law if they place previous opinions above the law? So apparently, it's not enough for the court's decision to be wrong. It must be really, really wrong. It seems the court is more concerned with their reputation than upholding their oath of office. Now, Justice Breyer wasn't the only one to bring up politicization. Justice Sotomayor took a slightly different angle. "What hasn't been at issue in the last 30 years is the line that Casey drew of viability. There's been some difference of opinion with respect to undue burden, but the right of a woman to choose, the right to control her own body, has been clearly set for since Casey and never changed. You want us to reject that line of viability and adopt something different. 15 justices over 50 years, or I should say 30 since Casey has reaffirmed the basic viability line, four have said no, two of them members of this court. But 15 justices have said yes, of varying political backgrounds. Now, the sponsors of this bill, the House bill in Mississippi, said we're doing it because we have new justices. The newest ban that Mississippi has put in place, the six-week ban, the Senate sponsors said we're doing it because we have new justices on the Supreme Court. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts? The question of when a child in the womb receives legal protection has been the central issue since Roe was decided in 1973, almost 50 years ago. So while the Roe case, later reaffirmed by Casey, set that milestone at the point of viability, that only settled the controversy in the minds of the justices. Every year since the Roe decision, thousands of people per year have demonstrated on the steps of the Supreme Court their unwillingness to accept the court's decision. Justice Sotomayor asked if the court will survive the stench of the perception that their interpretation of the Constitution is merely a political act. Since everyone currently on the court had to pledge fealty to Roe v. Wade as part of their confirmation in the Senate, I would say they have been living under that stench for almost 50 years. The question I have is, will this country survive the stench of denying constitutionally protected rights to the most vulnerable among us simply to appease a political party? Justice Sotomayor went on. Virtually every state defines a brain death as death. Yet the literature is filled with episodes of people who are completely and utterly brain dead responding to stimuli. There's about 40% of dead people who, if you touch their feet, the foot will recoil. There are spontaneous acts by brain dead people. So I don't think that a response to by a fetus necessarily proves that there's a sensation of pain or that there's consciousness. Justice Sotomayor has received some very harsh criticism for this question, but I think it's an important one. If the Constitution says you cannot be deprived of life without due process, which happens to be my legal argument against abortion, figuring out when life begins would be an important step. Sotomayor claims that 40% of brain-dead people react to stimuli and have spontaneous acts. Does that statement hold up? Well, Merriam-Webster defines brain death as final cessation of activity in the central nervous system, especially as indicated by a flat electroencephalogram for a predetermined length of time. If there is no activity in the central nervous system, then there can be no spontaneous actions. Since a flat electroencephalogram may not rule out reflexive movements similar to touching of the foot, Justice Sotomayor seems to have a point. So I searched federal law for a definition of brain death, but could not find one. Well, this makes sense since the power to define medical conditions was never delegated to the United States. However, I did find it in the Mississippi Code annotated. An individual who has sustained either A, irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory function, or B, irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem, is dead. A determination of death must be made in accordance with accepted medical standards. There has been medical evidence that children in the womb react to stimuli, but is that enough to prove life? Now, if their reactions are merely reflexive, such as flinching from pain, proof of life might be questionable. According to the Mayo Clinic, by 16 weeks gestation, the baby's eyes and limbs move on their own. This spontaneous movement shows activity in the baby's brain. Furthermore, according to the Charlotte Lozier Institute, a recent review of the evidence concludes that from the 15th week of gestation onward, the fetus is extremely sensitive to painful stimuli, and that this fact should be taken into account when performing invasive medical procedures on the fetus. It is necessary to apply adequate analgesia to prevent the suffering of the fetus. If, at 15 weeks gestation, it is necessary to protect the baby from suffering, then doesn't the baby also deserve the protection of their life? There have even been reports of the baby in the womb attempting to get away from the abortionist's tools. If the child in the womb has a consciousness to attempt to escape from danger, can we not agree that it's alive and deserving of our protection? There was so much more in these oral arguments that I do not have time to deal with them here. The question of undue burden, or is the opposition to abortion merely a religious view? The relative safety of abortion compared to giving birth, even the assertion of Justice Sotomayor that the Supreme Court has the final word on what is constitutional, are all worthy of further study. Whether I cover those topics in another episode or not, I will certainly review the court's decision when it's released. Regardless of where you stand on the topic, it is clear that the question of abortion will not be leaving the social discussion anytime soon. And I believe that is probably the key issue. I'm sure by now you've determined what my position is on abortion, but here I'm focusing on this idea of stare decisis. As Justice Breyer focused on, you know, we don't want to overturn a previous opinion because it makes us look bad, because people won't trust us. We treat this as special. He says because it's rare. None of these things really tend to hold up. Roe v. Wade is special partially because the court made up this idea that a woman's right to liberty supersedes the right of the child to live, and never even discussed the, in, at least in Roe, never even discussed the life of the child growing within her. Now, I've already talked about the Texas abortion bill and its six-week limit, but here we have the Mississippi bill. And the question really is, does the logic, does the legal basis for either Roe or Casey hold water? Does it stand up to scrutiny? And the answer, I believe, is no. Because it is obvious that children can survive outside the womb before they're born. The fact that they haven't been born may make it, you know, if they remain in the womb longer, it may improve their chances, but they're obviously alive. So if they're obviously alive, how can you deprive them of that life simply for the convenience of the mother? And again, if the mother's life is in danger, if there's serious health implications, that's another issue. That's where the due process of law comes in. But that's not what we're talking about most of the time. That's the oh, look, a squirrel. That's the look over here at the corner case, the oddity, the outlier, and let's make law based on that. Or more accurately, let's issue opinion based on that. Now, my biggest issue here is the bias with which the court holds on to its previous opinions. And this has been reinforced by the Senate demanding fealty to Roe v. Wade for any federal judge that they deem to interview. We've seen it with all the recent Supreme Court nominations. It's always a question of, do you support Roe v. Wade? Do you support stare decisis? Interesting is how rarely you hear people ask, well, do you support the Constitution and what it actually says? But as part of this discussion, Justice Kavanaugh, he had interesting questions for the justices. And he was asking if since the language of the right to abortion is not found in the Constitution, well, then the Constitution is neutral on abortion. I don't think that holds water either. I didn't get into the details. It's one of those things I didn't have time for. But he asked specifically, why should this court be the arbiter rather than Congress, the state legislatures, state Supreme Courts, the people being able to resolve this? Now, he says, and there'll be different answers in Mississippi and New York, different answers in Alabama than California, because there are two different interests at stake, and the people in those states might value those interests somewhat differently. Why is that not the right answer? And that is a very good question. I kind of hinted to it when we were talking with reviewing Justice Sotomayor's questioning and the statement that the court is the final arbiter of what is and isn't constitutional. Problem is, the Constitution doesn't give them that authority. They simply assumed it, and in fact, they actually made it up. But that's a whole other discussion. But the question is the court neutral? And my answer is, they haven't been. They have placed their thumb on the scale of justice based on a prior court's opinion. That isn't the rule of law. That's the rule of judges. And that, to me, is probably the longest and most dangerous legacy of both Roe and Casey. Yes, I have a position on abortion, but to me, the problem, Roe, Casey, and a litany of others, Obergefell, the Affordable Care Act, these are all from a constitutional standpoint of a similar type. It is the court trying to come to a political solution and finding a judicial way of getting there. Whether it's a majority of the court wanted to legalize abortion, so they had to find a way to do it, to the court wanted to find a way to enforce homosexual marriage on all 50 states, so they found a way to invent something in the Constitution that allows it. And while there is some justification for some of those positions, they ignore the infringement of rights on the other side. Now, Justice Sotomayor asked, you know, would the court survive the stench of overturning Roe? My question is, how do you survive the stench of 50 years of placing your opinion, a bad opinion, a poorly justified opinion, above the actual law? That's the stench I think they need to worry about. And that is the stench I believe history will judge them by. But there's more to this than just the Roe and Casey and Mississippi cases. See, what we've developed over time is the courts superseding their position above the law. And because of that, because of the power that they have assumed to themselves, well, people look to them to both make law and enforce their position. For example, during a CNN newsroom discussion, one of the commentators said, that's what we're working with this court, in the sense that we want to give the states the power from the conservative standpoint, and that goes against science. So then just forget about science and make up standards as we go along. Well, I don't know about science, but I do know about the Constitution. And the point is, the federal government was never authorized to deal with this. Or medical decisions of any sort are not delegated to the United States. Therefore, it's not up to the federal government. Now, yes, there are scientific issues at hand. It's one of the reasons why I don't mind a debate as to when the fetus in the womb receives protections, as long as it's based on scientific evidence. Things like the child's reaction to stimuli, to spontaneous movement. That, to me, those are signs of life. And if we have life, we need to protect life. But it seems to me that much of the arguments against the Mississippi case define science as a woman gets to choose no matter what, never forgetting there are consequences for those choices. That's why I say this is not going away. Regardless of which side, which direction the court goes, and it's not a binary solution, it's not a thumbs up or a thumbs down. There's a lot of gray area that the court will probably come down in that gray area. This is not going away. This is not going away because we do have a fundamentally divided nation on this topic. And it's divided along a very simple line. Does the child in the womb matter? And that's really what it boils down to. When does the child in the womb matter? And right now, I think as a nation, we have a very dysfunctional standpoint of it matters if the mother wants it. It matters if the child is killed in a crime. But it doesn't matter to some if the mother doesn't want it. And I think whether it's the Texas or the Mississippi abortion cases are really America finally, I should say the court, finally coming to grips with how badly it messed up in Roe and in Casey, and trying to find some way to fix some of the mistakes without looking too foolish. And that's my opinion of what I've seen so far. We'll see what happens when the court comes up with its opinion. I will certainly be back to discuss it when they do. Now, I have to take a break, but before I do, please head to the website, constitutionstudy.com. Help the work that we're doing here. There's a lot of information. There's articles, there's videos, there's podcasts. You can use them, you can share them, you can ask questions, you can support the work that we're doing here. Check it out, and if you have questions, ask them, let me know. If you want me to answer a question here on the radio, I'm still looking for them. Just check the box, go to constitutionstudy.com, click on the Ask a Question button, check the box that says you want it answered on America Out Loud Talk Radio. I'll be more than happy to do that. Also, please head over to healthycell.com/outloud. That's right. It's time to upgrade your vitamins. Forget the pills. Take an easy-to-use gel pack. You can mix it in your food or drink or just take the shot directly. It tastes pretty good, and it gives your body the cellular nutrition it needs. Now, they've got several different formulas. I don't know about you, but sometimes you have a hard time falling asleep. My wife has that all the time. Well, we use REM sleep. It helps you get drowsy, helps you fall asleep and stay asleep so you can wake up refreshed and ready to go. And just like all of the Healthy Cell products, you get 20% off as an America Out Loud listener. Just go to healthycell.com/outloud, pick any of their formulas, you'll get 20% off that first order. And I'm sure if you try it, you'll like it and come back for more. Again, that's healthycell.com/outloud.
I'm excited to talk about a new product from Healthy Cell, AC11. This is a patented bioactive extract of Uncaria tomentosa from the Amazon rainforest. It supports cell DNA repair and health span. It's a dietary supplement. I'm excited to try it. Many are interested in longevity and attenuation of senescence. We know that telomere length and other biologic measures are related to senescence in clinical and preclinical studies, particularly of animal models. And I can tell you as a doctor, dietary supplements do hold the promise of attenuating repair and damage in our body due to stress, physical wear and tear, sunlight, etc. And there's a tremendous opportunity for supplements to help us in this area. And so Healthy Cell has brought a product to market for you to try as part of your health portfolio. So please go to healthycell.com and in the promotional code, list out loud for 20% off your first purchase of products from Healthy Cell. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per month. But by simply keeping our immune system strong, we can stay healthy and put our worries at ease. One little known way to do this is by taking AC11, a patented supplement from a plant in the Amazon rainforest. Studied for over 20 years and backed by over 40 scientific peer-reviewed studies, taking AC11 has been proven to extend the life of immune cells called leukocytes, allowing you to boost immunity naturally. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of AC11. That's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. That's right, you've rejoined the Constitution study, and today we're looking at, well, the courts. We took a look first at the oral arguments in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health. We did that at the top of the program. And now let's take a look at some of the other things besides that particular case. There's been a couple of interesting cases that we've been dealing with in the court system. Now, for example, most of you know that the Biden administration, Biden announced that he planned to issue an executive order. I don't remember actually ever seeing an executive order to mandate private businesses require a vaccine, but OSHA put out some regulations. And that got put on hold by a court. Now, a lot of people have said it's been overturned, it's been stopped. No, it's been suspended. Several courts have said, listen, we're putting an injunction because we think you're going to lose on the merits, but they haven't actually lost yet. Those cases have been consolidated, and they've been assigned by lottery to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is currently working through that problem. Now, it should be no surprise that the Biden administration is not really happy that this mandate has been put on hold, that it's been enjoined by so many of the circuit courts. So back late November, President Biden, his administration, asked the Sixth Circuit to reject the order from the other appeals courts and to reinstate the Occupational Safety and Health Administration's vaccine mandate for private businesses. This didn't go over so well. Now, different circuits have come to different reasonings behind this, and simply delaying this has been a problem. Of course, now OSHA has suspended the mandate while it's going through the courts. But think about this. The future, the fate of your right to do business, to be employed without government overreach, for a business owner to actually, own and control their business, including their hiring practices, to negotiate freely for employees, sits in the hands of a handful of justices in the Sixth Circuit. Well, let's face it, no matter what happens in the Sixth Circuit, it's almost assuredly going to end up at the Supreme Court. So your rights now will rest in the hands of a handful of oligarchs. Oh, I know they don't think of themselves as oligarchs, and they wouldn't call themselves oligarchs, but everyone's waiting for a quote-unquote ruling. Except judges don't rule. They opine. And the very idea that these judges, that you're waiting for their ruling, well, doesn't that sound a little bit like the condition the colonies were in when they declared independence? Doesn't it sound like one of the, in fact, like the very first grievance listed when talking about the king and the Declaration of Independence? First grievance reads, "He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good." Now, let's face it, the vaccine mandate is not a law most wholesome and necessary for the public good, although apparently the Biden administration thinks so. But that's now going to be in the hands of judges. See, I thought this is the government of the people, by the people, and for the people. That doesn't sound like it to me when the people can be dictated to by a bureaucrat and their fate is in the hands of a group of judges. Doesn't sound too much like self-government to me. Now, there are things we can do. I've talked about this before. We need to have our states standing up to protect us. They are, you know, they created the federal government. They need to put it back in its box. But this is another example of thinking, how often do your rights exist? Are they exercised at the behest or at the sufferance of a court? Now, courts get involved with a lot of different things. There's a couple items from the Epoch Times I want to note. First is that the Justice Department filed an antitrust lawsuit trying to block U.S. Sugar Corp. from buying its rival, Imperial Sugar. According to the complaint, or the Department of Justice, the deal, if it goes forward, would mean that just two companies have the overwhelming majority of refined sugar sales in the U.S. Southeast, the department said, which could drive up prices. All right, well, let's stop and think about this for a second. I want to think about this. I want to bring in the other case, and I want to go deeper. But let's start with this. What is the main driver of sugar prices in the U.S.? Do you think it's a lack of competition between these businesses, or is it U.S. sugar tariffs? So, reading from the USDA's own website, imports of sugar into the United States are governed by tariff rate quotas, which allow a certain quantity of sugar to enter the country under a low tariff. Well, that basically means that if something is more than that certain amount, then they don't have a low tariff. So basically, the government has put these tariffs in place and other programs that raise the price of sugar. So here you have the Department of Justice going, oh, see, if we let these two companies get together, well, there won't be enough competition to drive down prices, while it's actually the federal government that's helping to keep those prices up. Now, there's another one. See, the Federal Trade Commission has sued chipmaker NVIDIA for its purchase of chip designer ARM. Now, this kind of hits me close to home. I spent 30 years in IT. I've used NVIDIA chips. They make some very nice graphics processors. They're used, again, for graphics, but they're also used for any sort of deep computing, AI, anything that does a lot of what's called floating point math. So NVIDIA wanted to buy ARM. Now NVIDIA makes chips, ARM designs chips. Well, the deal would make a pretty powerful company, but the Federal Trade Commission is worried about is it going to hurt the growth of new technologies? Quoting in this case from Epoch Times, the FTC is suing to block the largest semiconductor chip merger in history to prevent a chip conglomerate from stifling the innovation pipeline for next generation technologies. This is from the FTC Bureau of Competition Director Holly Vedova. This proposed deal would distort ARM's incentive in chip markets and allow the combined firm to unfairly undermine NVIDIA's rivals. Now, let's take a look at these two situations, these two cases, from a little bit of a higher level. In both cases, you have the federal government stepping in, attempting to stop an economic action, a transaction, because they claim that it will hurt something. In the case of sugar, they say, well, there won't be enough competition and it'll drive up the price of sugar. In the NVIDIA deal, it's, well, you know, it will give NVIDIA too much control and it could stifle innovation. Now, in the abstract, both cases seem to have merit, right? If you if one company buys up all the competition, then, well, there'll be less people to compete with it, and that would kind of expect you to lead to prices going up. I like to use the example of Mr. Vanderbilt. See, Vanderbilt ran some ferries on, I believe, the Hudson River. And what he would do is he would undercut his prices to drive his competition out of business. And then once they were out of business, he would try raising his prices. But as soon as he raised his prices, competition came back in. So while at the first case, I say there may be some merit to the question of if we end up with just a handful of companies controlling a market, can they control the market? Can they manipulate the market to their own benefit? Yes, that's true. Same way with the chip manufacturers, right? If NVIDIA makes the chip and ARM is a division of NVIDIA and they design the chips, they can design the chips in a way that would benefit NVIDIA's manufacturing technology. It's not too dissimilar from the situation that Apple had many years ago, where Apple owned the chip manufacturing that they used in their computers, and they also owned the software, most of the software, the operating system software that ran on those chips. In fact, IBM has been doing this for decades. We're all familiar with the IBM personal computers, but their bigger systems, what's called their RISC systems and their mainframes, one of the reasons they are so powerful and so stable is because IBM owns both the chips and the system that runs on the chips, the operating system, and they get to work together. Now, the problem you end up with when Apple did this is, in order to control their platform, they made it expensive for people, third parties, to make product for it. And so there could be something similar in what they're talking about with the NVIDIA, right? So imagine, NVIDIA has a customer. They could have their chips designed that would benefit their customers or their product line. And is that a potential problem? Potentially, yes. But here's the question that nobody seems to be asking. Should be two questions. First, is the federal government the right place to determine what is and is not best? In other words, is it the federal government's job to decide when a company is too big or controls too much of the market? Is it the federal government's job to determine which manufacturers would own too much control of what product and to break them up? By the way, you see this talked about a lot with big tech. We saw it with AT&T. We saw it with Microsoft. We saw it with IBM, where the government came in and said, you are too big. You're too much in control. We are going to break you up. Is the federal government the right one to make that decision? Because while people may say, well, you know, is it best for the people? Governments don't do things because they're best for the people. They're bureaucrats. They look at what's going to be best for them and their futures, their jobs. In other words, they may look at this and sure, somebody at the Department of Justice may think that having only two major sugar manufacturers, sugar processors in the Southeast is a bad thing. That's their opinion. Is that the opinion of the entire country, or at least a majority of the country, or a majority of the people in the Southeast? What if the people in the Southeast want this merger because they see a benefit to it? So is the federal government the best place to do it? I contend not. But then we've got an even more important question. Is this something that the federal government is authorized to do? Now, yes, Congress is able to make rules to regulate interstate commerce and commerce with foreign nations. And much of the sugar in America is imported. So they can make regulations about importing it. They can make regulations about its sale in and out of the country, in between the states, to make all the sales regular. Does that mean they have the authority, that we delegate to them the authority to determine when a company's too big? Because I've seen that nowhere in the Constitution. So we have the federal government exercising a power we have not delegated to it, meaning the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are both committing federal crimes. They're violating the Constitution of the United States, the supreme law of the land. They're attempting to deprive the owners of these four companies of control of their company with questionable due process. In other words, what they're asking for is they're asking the judicial branch to set aside the rights of the owners of these four companies in lieu of what they believe to be the greater good. Basically, due process means they have to protect the rights of the individuals involved, which is exactly what the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are both attempting to subvert. Now let's take a look at a couple of state issues. You're all familiar with. You've all heard about the Kyle Rittenhouse case and how not only was he found not guilty, that what he had done was self-defense, not murder. Many of you are probably also familiar with the fact that the defamation of this man in the media and even within the prosecution has been atrocious. The federal administration has, I believe, defamed and slandered Mr. Rittenhouse, and I don't know what the prosecutor was doing. It was ugly. I've talked about that before, and I've gone into more details about that before. Well, a state senator in Oklahoma, Nathan Dam, has filed Senate Bill 1120, called Kyle's Law. Let me start with that. I hate when you name laws after people. Right? This is that part's a political stunt, but let's go on. According to a press release from Dam's office, under Dam's legislation, if a person is charged with murder but is found not guilty due to justifiable homicide, the state would have to reimburse the defendant for all reasonable costs, including loss of wages, legal fees incurred, and other expenses involved in their defense. When a homicide is determined to be justified and the accused establishes that he had sustained injury due to malicious prosecution, then that person would be rewarded fair and just compensation. Now, this is interesting. And again, to me, this is interesting on a couple levels. One is, as often happens, we're dealing with legislation based on an emotional reaction. I don't see a problem with compensating the accused for the cost of their defense in certain situations. The problem you run into is, okay, when is the prosecution malicious or not? And maybe I haven't read the legislation. Maybe it goes into more details. But it's a scenario when you see, okay, if you are charged with murder, and again, the law, as I understand it, according to the press release, specifically deals with murder, and you're found not guilty due to justifiable homicide, meaning you were justified, you were in defending your life at the cost of someone else's life, then the state pays for your reasonable cost for your defense. That's fine. But if the accused can establish that there was malicious prosecution, which the Free Legal Dictionary defines as an action for damages brought by one against whom a civil suit or criminal proceeding has been unsuccessfully commenced without probable cause and for a purpose other than that of bringing the alleged offender to justice. All right, let me unpack that for a minute. Remember, probable cause. Probable cause is the cornerstone of any prosecution, right? Is there probable cause that a crime was committed? Is there probable cause that the accused committed the crime? Is there evidence to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that that is true? All right, so you got two probable causes and you have a reasonable doubt. So when someone is either sued or charged with a crime and it is found that the proceedings were commenced without probable cause, you have what's called malicious prosecution, and you can sue for malicious prosecution. But notice, according to the Free Legal Dictionary, for the purpose other than that of bringing the alleged offender to justice. And that's where things get a little sticky. Now, so let's use Mr. Rittenhouse as an example. I believe there was malicious prosecution. I believe there's prosecutorial misconduct. I think there was evidence of that. The question is, was there malicious prosecution? Was there a lack of probable cause? Well, based on some of the videos I've seen, there certainly was a lack of probable cause that Mr. Rittenhouse committed murder. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV. I haven't had access to everything that the jury saw. I'm looking from the outside. But when it comes to the Oklahoma law, the idea being is, okay, if you are accused of murder and it's found that, and you're found not guilty for justifiable homicide, your defense costs are covered. But if you can show that there was malicious prosecution, that you have sustained an injury due to malicious prosecution, whether, in other words, there was no probable cause, or the agenda was something other than bringing the accused to justice. If you had another agenda, like say, oh, I don't know, pushing gun control legislation, well, then that person would be awarded fair and just compensation. Now, again, I think emotional events lead to bad law. Outliers lead to bad law. I want to see the rest of this law before I decide if it's good or bad, though. But what you're seeing is a reaction to not simply the courts, but in this case, the prosecution and the media and in many cases, I believe the different administrations. So, but again, it's another situation where Mr. Rittenhouse's life has been unalterably changed, partially because of the actions he took to go assist others and then be willing to defend himself when he was attacked, but also by the way the courts and the judicial system treated him. And since we're talking about self-defense, let's talk about what's going on up in Montana. Now, Montana approved what's called permanent carry legislation last year. And they also ended the prohibition of carrying firearms on public college and university campuses throughout the state. A district judge on the other day granted the State Board of Regents' request for a permanent injunction against the legislation that sought to allow firearms on campuses. Now, I'm reading from a Bearing Arms article where it says, Montana's Constitution gives the Boards of Regents the authority to regulate the university system, and Judge McMahon agreed with the board that their power includes setting campus firearms policies. He declared that part of the law dealing with the university system to be unconstitutional. Well, I'd like to remind Mr. McMahon and the Montana Board of Regents that the state constitution is not the supreme law of the land. It is superseded by the Constitution of the United States, which says the right of the people to both keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, yes, the Board of Regents has the authority to regulate the university system, but that does not give them the authority to simply ignore the supreme law of the land. But here again, we have a judge that, rather than following their oath, rather than recognizing the supremacy of the Constitution of the United States, I don't even know what the Montana Constitution says about lawful carry, simply ignores that because, well, he thinks that the Board of Regents should have the authority to infringe on the rights of employees, faculty, staff, and students if they want to go to a state-funded school. Now, the law specifically states universities, public colleges and universities. If these were private schools, that would be different. These are not private schools. These are public schools. So once again, you have a law that has been refused. A judge has refused or sent to a law that in this case is wholesome and I believe necessary for the public good based on a limited interpretation of the laws at hand. I'm curious to see where this goes. Will the Montana Supreme Court pick it up? Will they not? I don't know. But again, if we are ruled by judges, if a judge can simply say, you know what, this is right, I find it unconstitutional, or really, what about the Constitution of the Montana or of the United States? We've got a problem. And again, I'm picking on gun control. It could be anything. What happens when, this is one I'm waiting to see go through the courts, but what happens when you have a right to something, but it's made so expensive you can't exercise it? See, there's a school district in Minnesota that there have been parents who filed for information from Rochester Public Schools in Rochester, Minnesota. This was done under Minnesota's Government Data Practices Act. In other words, the ability for citizens to request government data. They submitted to the school back on September 20th, and the request was made on a group called Equity in Education. The public school has informed, I guess it's the law firm representing these concerned parents, that it could cost upwards of $900,000 to complete a government records request. $900,000. I guess the process is the punishment. Sure, you can have access to the records. We're just going to charge you so much money that you can't afford it. I mean, imagine you're a parent that's looking for these records because you're curious about what's been going on in these schools. Parents are concerned about social justice, cultural competency, intersectionality, CRT. They want to know what's been going on in their schools that they pay for with their tax dollars. And while they have legal access to it, a $900,000 fee to do so seems to be more than simply outrageous. It's punitive. I don't know what it would take to charge $900. I mean, think about it. If you went down to your local Kinko's and you wanted to get photocopies, let's say you found all the documents, you put it on a USB drive and you wanted to print it, you're talking millions of pages to come up with a $900,000 charge. Is that really, is that how government is going to protect itself from the people it claims to serve? we'll just make it so ludicrously expensive that there's no way for you to actually get access to your rights. And again, this is going to go to court, and we're going to wait and see what the judges say. But my question is, why are we waiting to see what the judges say? I fully expect that these parents are going to go. I mean, they've got a law firm. They got to be expecting to sue. Where's the rest of the story? Where are the parents going to the school board going, what are you talking about? Do you all wish to be fired? If you're going to hide behind a ginormous bill, the actions that you're taking, you are fired. Period. When are they going to go to the state and saying, listen, this school is hiding information. They're refusing to provide it without an outrageous and punitive charge. They should get not one dime of state money until they now cough up all those records for free. Where's that? See, we've become so focused on the courts, we've become so litigious, we forget they're not the only solution. We don't want to be ruled by men and women in black robes. We don't want the ultimate authority to be 9 high priests in black robes telling us what the Constitution means. We created the Constitution. We created the federal government. We need to be in charge. Or we need to fire them and find people who will follow the rules. Otherwise, we are not the land of the free. We're not a self-government. This is not government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It's a government of bureaucrats, by judicial fiat, against the people. Now, I've been asked a lot lately, well, what do we do, Paul? What do we do? Well, I've talked about it before, and I'll probably talk about it again, but you start by getting control of your county and your school board, and then you work up. Now, do me a favor, please. Be sure to make AmericaOutloud.com your daily stop for all the latest news and happenings. It's important we all do our part, that we read and we share the stories, the articles, the podcasts, the videos, that we do everything we can to help secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.